is a listener-supported community radio station, and it is also a new platform for presenting innovative experimental works on the air. Tune in WGXC 90.7 FM, Agra, Hudson, Catskill, and points beyond. Listen to special programs of performance, words, sounds, and other rare and delicious items. Transmitting the arts all day every Saturday, and weekdays after midnight. Here is there.
Because tonight is about both research and cooperation, it occurred to me that delivering a talk from a lectern has actually been generated through going back at least to Welsh ministers, if not any earlier, was something to do with where you stood in the room to get the echo of the voice, and somewhere where you could stand with the light, and somewhere where you could balance a very large, heavy, revised Bible. However, since then, we have been taped up, the lights vary, I don't actually need to stand there at all, but the lectern is still the same size. They move their camera very cleverly, but the lectern is still the same size. Page 154, I know it backwards, page 154 of Whitaker's Almanac gives, amongst the astronomical information, and this has not been something that has been in the book for long, a list of artificial satellites, updated every year. Take a quote, 1980, there were 105 pushed up. In 1981, there were 123 artificial satellites. Every satellite is listed, what it's doing, and when it'll come down. The usefulness of artificial satellites is increasingly for accessibility to information, for exchanging data. As more and more satellites go up, as they become easier to focus, as in effect they become rougher, in a way, because the technology is improved, they can be handled more roughly. That is, that you can focus on them with cheaper and cheaper equipment, because they are better. As this happens, there is increasing availability via satellites for a whole range of information, but the storage of information is therefore comparatively becoming more expensive. Having got it. Now, if this is so, which it would appear to be, then there is a new limitation coming in on the use of satellites, and that is the clock, the 24-hour clock around the world. Because if they become cheaper and people allow for that, and the storage of the information you can get from them becomes comparatively more expensive, then everyone wants to use them at times when they don't have to store the information but can process it immediately. And therefore they want to use it at the time of day when jolly people have finished their breakfast and are in working and before they go home, etc., etc. And this provides an enormous imbalance in the world at the moment if you look at the countries which in fact take advantage of such satellites. Now, the reason I mention that is that it is a fact of communication theory that may well change. But at the moment, that is the situation, that reversal. And I'm going to suggest that this is just the same in relation to both the nature of research, its considered usefulness, and indeed its actual use, as opposed to its assumed usefulness. Back to the lectern. Therefore, at the moment, in that instance of very, very sort of highly developed technological exchange methods, immediacy would appear to be a limiting factor through its economy, not the other way around. But because it's cheap, it's going to be more difficult. Other forms of, because to a large extent, research in my office, and indeed cooperation, is still pretty steam age. And what is nice is that because it's steam age, it's somehow it's caught up on the helical of advancement, and we're coasting ahead at the moment through being behindhand. But that won't last, and I'll give you examples of that. Therefore, I'd like to just refer to a report of the phenological observations for 1908. Before the First World War, not much use of, what's his name had been arrested. When was Crippen got by telephone? First international use of telephone for useful purposes. Anyhow, 1908. Well, anyhow, before the First World War, you know that. Now, this report comes out every year, and you all know what Phenological Society was about. And it was entirely voluntary. And amongst the things that you'd get with the booklet was the next year's form to fill in. You were an observer. You were an observer in various stations over the United Kingdom, about 35 stations, I think. And this was to someone in the Caradoc area, which of course is the Welsh bit of the Severn Valley. Right, here's the form. From the Royal Meteorological Society, because obviously the phenological observations were carried out by or under the auspices of that society. Now, you've got a form like this. Plants. I'll just list a few of them. These were the plants you were asked to observe. And you were asked to write down the date of flowering. All voluntary. Plants. Hazel, coltsfoot, wood anemone, blackthorn, garlic hedge mustard, horse chestnut, hawthorn, white oxeye, dog rose, black knapweed, harebell, greater bindweed, and ivy. Instructions to the observers. A. Observe the same individual trees and shrubs each year, and as regards herbaceous plants, those growing in precisely the same spots. Think of some of the architectural surveys done in relation to new town planning. Think back that far. B. Watch carefully for the appearance of the first flowers. Note, in the case of the hazel, the fertile flowers only are to be observed. They are little bright red flowers, which as a rule open directly after the barren flowers or catkins. That's the flower section. Birds. Song thrush, swallow, cuckoo, nightingale, flycatcher, and swallow. Date. Instructions. The date on which the note of the song thrush is first heard after January the 1st should be given. After January the 1st. Clearing it a little, make it a little easier for you to take part in this research, to cooperate in such research. Don't bother about January the 1st. We know what happens this summer. Afterwards, we'd like to know. It must not be mistaken for that of the missile thrush. You, I find difficulty in saying that one. The notes of the missile thrush are less musical and connected. The strain is altogether much shorter, and being repeated many times in succession, it wants the variety of that of the song thrush. Now, read page 8 in the telephone directory, telling you how to recognise the various bleep noises and what they mean, both on internal and overseas calls, and see whether they can explain it better than that. That's available to you in the phone box outside. Right, 2. The swallow may be distinguished from the house martin and the sand martin by its back being of a uniform glossy steel blue, almost black, by its long forked tail, and by the dingy white colour of its lower parts. You know, you've really got to spend some time looking at these little darlings after January the 1st, and listen. 3. Observers should be on their guard against imitations of the well-known note of the cuckoo. Duplication. you know, whether it's wicked to imitate, whether the original has intrinsically some more value than the imitator, even if it's only a noise, never mind a photocopy. Four, the observer should be certain that it is the nightingale that is heard, as the song thrush also often sings late in the evening, chiming again. Tricky. The flycatcher is a little greyish-brown bird fond of sitting on a post, rail, or perch, whence it can readily dart off and seize a fly, usually returning at once to its former station. Ah, useful knowledge. That helps the researcher. Insects: honeybee, wasp, small white butterfly, orange-tipped butterfly, meadow brown butterfly. Instructions: the date when the hive bee first visits the flowers. This must not be mistaken for the large white butterfly, which generally makes its appearance a little later than the small white one. General instructions: place the dates and names against the plants, birds, and insects in the list, and send the form, etc. Notes made at the time on any exceptional weather and its influence on farm and garden crops, trees, birds, insects, etc. When I purchased this book and that form in a junk shop in Ludlow last summer, out fell a letter from someone who's later to become extremely famous, namely Mr. F. A. Bellamy, the astronomer from Oxford. But in 1910, April the 8th, he wasn't all that famous. And this is a letter from him, which fell out of the book, for St. John's Road, Oxford. I checked the address and it was the same Bellamy. Dear Mr. Forrest, I do not know whether I've written to you before. I've sent to several of my friends in England and Scotland concerning phenological observations. We rather want a station somewhere in your area, and I wonder whether you or one or two in the Caradoc Society would undertake such observations annually. You know, I suppose, that this present government, because of the satellites, have said that there is no longer any reason for the Royal Astronomical Society to carry out ground observations of weather and things. And they are no longer going to supply the free little measuring cups for rain and things like that. If people want to do it, then they'll send lists to the manufacturers. You can imagine those manufacturers saying, hold on for the orders, boys. You can carry up, you can go back, but now we've got satellites, sorry, we don't want you to do any more measurements, hundreds of them all over the country, for centuries of recorded weather, frost and things, little machines. Never got paid, but at least had these little machines supplied free. But no, now we've got satellites, we don't need that. We rather want to... I send you a copy of the 1908 report, which you need not return. Value of books. And on pages 168 and 169, there does not appear to be any station in a large area except Stone, which, fun enough, is where I was born, Betley and Llangollen. I do not know how far you are from these places. I also send you one of the sheets giving certain instructions. You will see that there are not many plants to be observed, and they are the commonest. It would, of course, add to the value of the station if observing birds and insects were included. But though desirable, it's not essential that every observation required should be made, or that the return be considered as useless if incomplete. The observations do not take much time. All that is needed is to select two or three average spots, not unduly early or late, owing to soil or situation. For each plant and visit, those places occasional, when the plant should show fully open flowers. It is better to have two or three spots, because children and others often clear off early flowers, and the roadmen and gardeners, etc., have ways of cleaning up, undesirable to nature lovers. If Shrewsbury can be made a station, there's no reason why reading should not be commenced at once, though the earliest plant dates have passed, the dates of 1900. I'm pleased to note any such observations can be made year to year. I've been making these observations for Oxford since 1882. I've been much too occupied with astronomy to spare time for much field work. But I had the pleasure of gathering two plants in Buckinghamshire, which I never gathered before. Helibird viridis and Deuterata bulbifera. Yours sincerely, Bellamy. Now, again, shortage of paper. The reply wasn't a reply to Bellamy. It was a letter written by the man that Bellamy had written so carefully to, sending this book. Passing the buck, I won't read it, but writing to someone else saying, could you undertake to do what Mr. Bellamy asks in this case? I am too busy, etc., etc. Perhaps you could ask one of your friends if you don't do it. So obviously it never happened. That went on, but it was still in that book, and the form had never been filled in. The nature of loss of apparent probings in relation to research or indeed cooperation is something which we ignore at our peril.
Thank you.
two questions last night, which have some relevance now. One, I think, was made for mischievous purposes, and therefore it's probably the more interesting of the two. And that was, have you ever thought of, sort of doing away with your office and doing it on your own? The obvious straight answer was, don't be an ass. It's an office. It's not a one-man operation. We couldn't do it. It doesn't exist. I don't exist on my own. But I spelt out what appeared to be a very reasonable answer about, I wouldn't have that, I might have to cooperate two more, etc., etc. And therefore, in the answer, which was really in a way to get some usefulness out of what I suspect was a mischievous person, but might not have been, occurred to me this whole point of whether, in fact, cooperation has to be recognized by both sides as being just that. Certainly in architectural terms, whether in fact the cognizance, the pressing of flesh, the why don't we cooperate, has to be the first line in the process of exchange. You know, this absurd thing, and they still have it everyone now, a lot of people can operate ordinary keyboard computers, and they still get on so many this sort of thing, hello, or let's go now, what's your name, and get through those lines and start off. But normally, satellite time, you're not asking for particular cooperation, you're asking for performance that is beneficial to both sides. The second question was also interesting and still worries me, and that was a gentleman sitting towards the back in the now wholly unoccupied rows of seats, who said, you said that the only real social change, noticeable social change in your office is that everyone stayed the same age except you, and you've aged 25 years during the life of it. Why don't you carry on with older people, not partners or anything? And he qualified it. It was a very good question. And I said, I preferred the sort of gingering effect of people who I'd always been used to working with, although, my truss needed adjusting, my knee cracked, teeth were rubbery, but generally speaking, I'm sorry. But in fact, again, I'm not sure whether that is the reason, because I backslided a bit, and this has something to do with professional cooperation, because I said, of course, I do have a lot of consultants who are quite old, that's back newbie, and things like that, you see. And in fact, that isn't the real answer. The real answer is what I touched on, and will probably repeat several times this evening, is the fact that I'm not certain whether one actually needs that continuity and knowledge and experience from the past. I'm sure you do in some fields. Certainly in the way the legal system is structured in this country, you do, because of the common law aspect. But in architecture and planning and construction, I'm very doubtful. It takes me on to the next point, that is the interest that one should have in whether one calls it research, whether pure, and I say very little of our research is pure, but whether the interest in research or merely sort of constructive cooperation, which is not always the case, those two don't always go together, whether in fact it is dangerous to assume that, well, however arbitrary the particular task is, and however slight, etc., this will put us in good stead for the future. We are building up, after all, we're building up the data bank. This is very useful, it's a useful experience. Let's take a loss on this one, or let's put up a pretty noxious group of people, because really, collectively, this will be part of the enrichment of our not general, but particular knowledge. And this I'm questioning increasingly. And the reason for this is as patent as those two rather childish examples I gave. One of my theory on the use of satellites in exchanging information and the 24-hour clock, and two, on the whole nature of who asks what about what and in what form. In our present, our current, or at least the built-up nature of sort of research we do, we have done another method, which may be, because it was loose and rough, more fruitful than the more accurate methods that someone, and I think one of the most remarkable environmental, architectural, and communication researchers, very undervalued, and his work not known really, his other work known, and that is Professor Peter Cowan. But in his work over the years, right through from Nuffield Institute, right through the Center for Joint Planning Research with the LSE and things, staggering, fresh concern with accuracy. Ours has tended to be very rough, and therefore there is one of our very early research programs was in relation to the Fun Palace, and was to some extent, or to quite a large extent, generated by Gordon Pass. Now, we got him in. I knew of him, and funny enough, Joan Littlewood knew of him, and we both knew of him quite separately. She knew of him through his approach, his interest in the theatre. I knew of him because of a wonderful story about this madman in Richmond who had a computer running on 2,500 empty mustard tins, Coleman mustard tins. It was a water-operated computer. It was a yes or no pitch and pull thing, which is all the computer is anyhow, just yes or no, running off the mains. And there'd been a case in the local paper about them wondering why this domestic consumer was using quite so much water. And I went to see this computer, which was a hydraulic computer, working very well indeed. And there was Gordon. In those days, he used to collect the ash from the filter of his cigarette holders. and would collect these great piles of ash because he was interested in how ash settled and the shape of ash. Now, I had experienced Gordon several years earlier. I was delighted to see that it was the same man in Cambridge, where in fact he would stop anyone in the streets and say, "Have you got a little bit of time to help me with an experiment?" And that face, you know, you said, "Yes, yes, certainly." And he'd take it to this room in Jordan's yard where there was this, there was a very large mirror at one end of the room, enormous mirror. And then there was a series of wooden boxes. I think it had been an old, pigeonhole, but it was lying horizontal, sort of for letters, on a table towards the other end of the room. And each of these pigeonholes had big numbers above them. And he gave you brass table curtain rings. And you stood with your back to the mirror, and all you had to do, he shouted out numbers, and as he shouted them out, you had to throw brass curtain rings into that number as best you could. And of course he went faster and faster, and more of them bounced off and went to the wrong place. But it didn't matter, he was recording all this, etc., like that. And then the second thing you would do would be turn your back on the rings, on the box, and observe them and the numbers backwards in the mirror, and have to throw these rings over your shoulder into the boxes, and that would go quicker and quicker. And he produced some extremely interesting reports as a result of this. He also produced all sorts of reports for the Royal Air Force on the likelihood of enlistment possibilities for people into the Royal Air Force for the year 2008. Now, he was doing that in 1952. So now, having got Gordon involved at the Fun Palace, we then decided, and it was the first time he'd ever been involved. So he was involved with the military, and he was involved with cheating the water board in order to have a cheap, extremely accurate, but rather large and noisy computer. The first task that really cropped up for him was purely a mechanical one. And that was a simple question that, having decided, and this was really with cooperation with Frank Newby and others who had been involved far earlier than Gordon, having decided that it was a very good idea to use a large traveling crane at high level for various reasons, which I won't go into, but I'm sure are recorded somewhere, right across the building. The first question was, do we have one crane or two? Is it easier to, because the crane can be doing things, is it easier to have two cranes that operate from each end and come and meet and hand over things and go back and do their things and come and meet, or just one that has to go twice as far each time, just doing one, you see. Now, we had no way of working that out. Now, he had a way of working it out which satisfied us. And then he moved on to more difficult problems as to optimum size, optimum range of activities. And those generally we could understand, and I think we all agreed on that, which comes back into a question of duplication. Generally we all agreed that when in fact the very simplest of activity, not of servicing, this is voluntary activities, which we tried not to put a name onto, when the very simplest of activity required duplication in order to be available for other activities, the thing was too big. Have two, he always used to say. Why don't you build two? Now that was a sort of very tricky exercise. I mean, I hope I made it sound simple, but it wasn't simple. Not to actually be in any way satisfied that we'd got an optimum size for a random collection of objects and activities which could change. Now, going back to the activities, we then, because we had time to determine that if we're not going to give new names to activities, we're not going to have things like ballroom dancing or theatre, but we're going to define activities purely as the results of, as the collection of the sort of conditions people want, and someone else can put an activity on it. We'll build a thing, and then they can call it butterfly collecting or semi-nude mud wrestling or whatever. But we then did another point, which was here I may be using the wrong word. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's an optimization. But what we did with our questionnaires, which were punch card questionnaires, and we've done quite well with questionnaires over the years. We've only gotten two lots, Fun Palace and Generator. Fun Palace, 6,000 went out to any age person. We never wanted to know who they were filling them in. So, because the system was such that even if you filled them in jokingly, it could be useful. And of the 6,500, which I know is a small sample, though Gallup seems to be quite happy with small samples, we got 3,000 back, which is amazing. And these were punch cards ones. The point about this, not about the method, the point was that we asked people to mention things they would like to do, whether they had a title or not. And they could spend a whole sentence lying on my back with a glass of wine, observing giant spiders. Wouldn't be taken as a joke. It could be processed. But over and above the subject, all we asked them for was to say, over and above the sort of conditions you would normally expect to find for that activity, what would you like? And it's back to that business of January the 1st. Don't bother about before January the 1st. So we were only really scheduling the peculiar. And jumping 20 years and coming on to the generator survey, which was a bigger one, quite a good return, which I have the form here, which I might come into discussion, which I would welcome, if you feel we have time and stand it. There, in fact, we did the same over and above what you would normally expect. What would you like? And what interested me is that in looking at it tonight, and in explaining the form, which has a series of instructions on filling in the sheets, which aren't very difficult sheets. They have my old favorite, the affinity sheet. You try and mark out what things you think will louse up you doing other things and what doesn't matter. But over and above those three sheets, we have what I rather creepingly see called the luxury sheet, which is blank. And so did they in 1908. And I only got this last year, and that went out 10. I was very pleased that over and above anything people could ask, this is back to the, in a way, back to my point, aiming to miss. Over and above anything people could ask, you give people a chance to throw the system. Because I think that in relation to both research and cooperation, which I will speed up a bit, and I'll come on to this tomorrow, I'll try not to repeat myself tomorrow, it aiming to miss something is the tricky one, and maybe the key to what we should be doing. The only example I give as a sort of quick example is go to a fairground and start firing at a regular, reasonable regular speed at the ducks and try not to hit one. The collection of facts as such, which is increasingly undertaken, I don't quite know why. I mean, it isn't in order to publish Whitaker's Almanac. Whitaker's Almanac knows where to go for the information it contains. The information is already being collected. It is just putting it together and making sure that it's updated once a year. That's the brilliance of that magazine. And visual information as well. I mean, the actual, not only the maps at the end, but the photographic record of the year before is I would recommend it to anyone as a visual record of the previous year. But you can check weather, you can check tides, disasters, the year in architecture, how many satellites were launched, and how many dukes died. Anything in there. Now, that availability of information is something which I think is bordering on a continuous research program for us. If in fact, not that we know what questions to ask, but that we know how to retrieve where and when we might want, and that we know when the retrieval is no longer of value, that is that the content smells. Alistair Cook the other day based his whole program on various sort of surveys recently done in the United States. And he was sort of pointing out that assumed attitudes to society at the moment are, in fact, statistically quite incorrect. Not out of phase, but totally different. Now, he thought that was rather amusing. I thought it's rather frightening that no one was constantly taking advantage of the accessibility of the sort of information that he got from government reports. Now, just for an example, that he sort of said people are not reading less books, they're reading more. Television hasn't caused people to read less books in America, it's caused them to read more. And he quoted the numbers, etc., etc. Now, put that against another statistic, which the Board of Trade brought out, or whatever it's called now, that there are now registered far more video film shops than there are bookshops in this country. Now, some people shuddered at that thought. I just found it rather interesting, not particularly uplifting, but very interesting that we don't actually constantly have accessibility to things which now and again may be useful. And therefore, I'm suggesting that certainly in architecture, the business of research is is a question of knowing when to retrieve, not necessarily just where. Now, in the sight sensing kit, which I think there's some examples in the exhibition, but certainly in the book, here was another aspect of research where I don't think we, as a firm, did anything more than bring in sort of boffins. All we were trying to do was, in relation to houses which we'd already proposed, that is, that we proposed a system of building a steel-framed house that could be panelled in different ways, and that the panelling, over and above safety and moisture and thermal insulation, had various variants of acoustic control and visual control, both light from inside the house, lighting up the garden or blinding a motorist, and light from outside, like the sun waking you up too early in the morning. And the same with sound controls. And it was at the time when the Building Research Station was marketing that brilliant little do-it-yourself acoustic meter, if you remember, which you could buy. I think they've stopped now. I think the Open University took it over and loused it up. But anyhow, they were absolutely, you could record received sounds of a whole range of wavelengths in various scales by just the adjustment of a knob at the side. And they were £9.10, £9.50. So the sight sensing kit actually was related. It enabled us to chart back on our drawings areas where it might be nice to have a garden if you liked a lot of noise, or if you liked the sun, or where you might put the bed, etc., etc. But it wasn't anti or pro any condition. It just was in increasing choice in a measurable way before, and in three dimensions, in a three-dimensional grid, before you actually occupied the house. That is, the sight-sensing kit went with the first tenant before they moved in. And the whole cost of it and instructions, we worked out at just under £20. And we quoted two examples to make the point. Now, this was entirely done, this is a little sort of side element on research and cooperation. The work on it was entirely done for free for us by the Building Research Station, particularly their acoustics department, and the GLC scientific branch, because they hadn't been given that particular task before, and it was an interesting program. This has happened time and time again, and I'd like to pay credit to PERA, the Production Engineering Research Establishment at Melton Mowbray, who have been marvellous over the years, because we never have any money for research by others. They have very little for research by us. And it is, this is an aside now, but it's something which I would recommend if we're going to do a sort of happy tips on Thursday night sort of thing, that if in fact you are able to devise a prototypical process or a prototypical method of measurement, but selection of things to measure, a prototypical menu for existing researchers or existing manufacturers, and hint to them that although you only want to know this particular answer, who knows, it might be useful to them in the long run, very often they will take you up on that and say, yes, it might be. We found that with Fothergill and Harvey on Airmat, Fire the Threads. We found it with the people up in Halifax, where we talked about compression of fabrics in air structures, and they said there can't be compression. And we said, well, just look at the seams. The seams, the building is tensioned almost to bursting, and yet the seams are buckled. Now, if they're buckled, there must be one bit of thread in compression there. I mean, it can't be in tension. It couldn't buckle. See, and they did a lot of work for us. And are carrying on. There are various aspects, or simpler ones, which I may come on to, or not. However, in relation to the the nature of detailed investigations, it is important to, in a way, to do it in a certain degree of humility. That is, I do not believe the best research, certainly in our field, should ever start with some particular scoring point system in relation to the aims in view. You know, I don't really think that one should, and I'm sure in pure research this doesn't happen, but I am not talking about pure research tonight. I'm talking about very coarse research. And even if there has been an immediacy engendering such research, then I don't think you should carry in your own head a feeling of point system that as a result of what comes out, it's been a useful bit of research or a bad bit, because I don't think there can be good and bad research in that way as from the resultant point of view. To give an example, the sight sensing kit. What we used to sort of try and spell out to people, because we used these, though we never built the houses, we used them on existing houses, people who'd taken over. In those days it was a Waits building before, unfortunately I've forgotten his name. Anyhow, it was those sort of things. We sort of said, well look, we're interested about, you know, disturbing noise. And they said, oh, we tell you about disturbing noise, you know, milk bottles, and maybe we know we don't want to hear milk bottles at 6 in the morning, things like that. So we said, oh, well, midnight, if someone revs up a motorbike on the gravel, your shared pathway to your garage, from the garage next door, and takes off on his giant motorbike in the gravel, midnight, is that disturbing noise? You bet it is. So they said, right, if the new boyfriend brings your daughter back on his motorbike at 1 o'clock, makes exactly the same noise on the gravel, is that disturbing noise? No, because he'd been back on time. Yeah, I said, you know, be back before one. No, that'd be great relief. That's the sort of noise. Switch off here, get the Horlicks out, she's back. The other example we gave was dropped in our lap, which was a planning application for a house for a man in Southampton on a piece of land between the new trailer park, the container park by the North Docks up the Itchen, and the main road and the railway line. So it had terrific noise on both sides of it, and it was about, it had been housing, but they'd been cleared when they'd done the motorway and the new rail link and the motor rail grain stuff. So the land actually had never been taken off the planner's chart as not domestic land, though it was placed with these tracks things, you see. And this man bought a piece of the land, got a house design, absolute standard house, open windows, nice sort of open front door and thing, on 50 feet, not 50 yards, about 50 feet of land, quite a long site, between these things, you see. Put in the planning application, turned down straight away. And he went to appeal. He said, it's coloured housing. They said, you can't live there. It's 180 decibels, both sides, the best time, day and night. And to his credit, he kept quiet and paid for the appeal, went right to appeal, turned up, took it to the ministry, and only then did he bring his doctor. And this man had the most peculiar disease that required him to be subjected to heavy noise most of the day in order to stay alive. There's a man who was in this building today, I met by chance, but had met over the years, called Dennis Gunz, who's probably one of the most imaginative designers in the world today. But it happened that about 20 years ago, he designed and patented form of featherlight gramophone record, or it's called pickup head, which is now manufactured by all the leading firms, and which made him a millionaire very quickly. And he showed me the other day, he came over, he's got three places. He lives underground in LA, in an air structure on a roof of an office block in Manhattan, and in a tent, the doors of which are sealed with large helium-filled balloons on the beach at Acapulco, next to Frank Sinatra's property, which is surrounded by guards and wire fences. and no one's ever broken into his tent. Because who in their right mind would do anything with a tent with a giant balloon and on the beach? Now, he's actually, today and tonight, off tomorrow, in Harley Street. But his latest invention, which is patented and has been manufactured for 2 or 3 years, is, and if anyone's interested, I have to do it in detail, but it is a most incredibly simple way of something that's never been achieved before, that we know of, and certainly Frank Newby knows it, and I don't know it. It is a way of actually having a single skin air structure manufactured in such a way that you can fold it and it won't try and retain its original shape. And it is so simple, and you can fold any shape. Now, all he's doing at the moment is making extraordinary furniture, which you can fold and sit on, and fold. Almost, it's like plasticine to deal with. In fact, it's an air structure. But what interests me, and this is a little bit of sort of, this is onto the corporation side. All I said to him when he explained it to me was, would you mind if I thought about that? You've got the patent, but I thought about that idea times 1,000. That sort of cooperation, there's no particular aim in view. I was reminded, just in looking around the room, I should have a feeling, about the job that we're doing for the Royal Veterinary College, where, in fact, the cooperation, that there was an extraordinary range of requirements for worthwhile research in relation to eggs, bird's eggs, and the resultant bird. Of a fantastic range of detail, but only I understood it a little bit. I understand a bit more. This was going on in any case, but that there was felt by those who were doing the research, one in particular, that possibly a building could help. That was all. That possibly a building might increase the speed, the degree of accuracy, the value, etc., of such work. This is where the two bits tonight, that's why I talk about snakes and ladders, this is where the two bits come together. Only through them carrying on with their research have I been able to cooperate with them without, in a way, ever asking them for a brief. Because the brief was there in the work being done. The only brief was, would a building help it? And therefore, as in all best research, you not only are researching what is being done and what has been done, but research involves what could be done. Now, what can be done is often with the help of money, or a lot more people, or a lot more time. But it also, if we are any use at all, it can now and again be done with the help of architecture. And this, I mean, it's far more exciting than the exciting Tasmanian sand beach story, what we're involved with at the moment. And I'll go in more detail tomorrow.
You have been listening to the program Human Machine on WGXC. Listen on Saturday mornings to subsequent episodes, where we continue our conversation on the nature of being in an age of human-machine evolution.